teacher. If I could boil the research on professional learning to one word, I'd probably have to put it as ownership. How can students advocate for their own learning? How can students truly take ownership of their own learning? We've seen some of the poorest places in the country do amazingly dynamic things. Why? Because of school leadership. We've also seen places that have it all. They're not talking about 1-to-1, they're like 2-to-1. Every kid gets an iPad and a Chromebook, you know? And they're still teaching the way they taught 20 years ago, and their school, their kids happen to play really well. They play school really well, I should say, because they're pretty compliant kids. It is not just what we call LBTs, leaders by title. Leaders by action is who makes the change. But some of the best people we see are teaching in classrooms every day.
Welcome to the Rethinking Learning podcast series. I'm Barbara Bray. This is where I have conversations with educators, leaders, and change agents about their passion to transform teaching and learning. Welcome, everyone, to the Rethinking Learning podcast series. I'm so excited today. I'm talking with Tom Murray. I have been wanting to talk to him, and when he said yes, I was so excited. So let me introduce you to him first. Tom Murray serves as the Director of Innovation for Future Ready Schools, a project of the Alliance for Excellent Education, and he's located in Washington, D.C. I think you live in Pennsylvania. Is that right?
That's New Jersey. True. I live in Pennsylvania. That's right, Barbara.
Oh, I got it right.
and he's
co-author of the new ASCD book, Learning Transformed, 8 Keys to Designing Tomorrow's Schools Today. Oh, thank you so much, Tom, for being here. I'm just so excited.
Well, Barbara, I have to say, and I appreciate that lead-in, but I have to say I'm just as much a fan of your incredible work with personalized learning and student agency. So when you ask me, it's truly my honor to be here. But what an honor it is to join you today in the incredible work that you are doing. And thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, you're so sweet. I started doing a little bit of research. I read your book, and I've also been following you for a long, long time. And I thought it'd be kind of nice if you kind of introduce a little bit about you, share about you, your family, your lovely family, and your former life as a teacher and principal.
Sure. Thanks, Barbara. You know, they are truly who and the reason why I do the work that I do. You know, when I keynote different events or I get to speak in front of people quite often, virtually every week, what I'll often do is I start with pictures of my family, pictures of my babies, and showing this is the lens that I work through. This is the reason that I do what I do. You know, to have young kids coming up, my little girl, Paisley, she's a second grader, soon to be second grader, I should say, in a public school here in Pennsylvania, a wonderful, wonderful district known as Parkland School District, to give them a shout. And my little boy who just turned 4, he's got a couple years yet, but they are the lens that I see things through. You know, when I try and make decisions and working nationally, I look at what would I want for my own kids, and that's really become the barometer for me of if it's good enough for my kids, it's good enough for every kid. And so it's not that it's about my kids per se, it's just that's the lens that I look through. And so if I want it for my kids, I want to make the assumption that other parents would want it for theirs as well. And that really informs the work that I do currently nationally. As you said, I work as the Director of Innovation for Future Ready Schools. As part of that work, I get to work with school leaders from coast to coast, whether it's running events around the country with hundreds of leaders and having them network and collaborate and communicate and share best practices and celebrate some of the great things we're doing. Or if it's running things like leadership retreats or being at conferences where I often see you somewhere around the country in places like that. But they are the lens. My family is the lens that I look through, and through my own babies, it's really made me a much better educator. And you mentioned really my experience because I haven't always worked in DC. And one of the things I always find myself saying is I'm not this 50,000 foot policy person that's never been there, that's never done that, that's trying to tell school leaders what to do, but they've never actually done it themselves. I spent 14 years in public schools in Pennsylvania, first as a teacher, number of years in fourth grade. I moved to middle school. I taught middle school for a couple years. I'll tell you, that's a heck of an experience for anybody that's ever been a middle school teacher, right? I then became a middle school principal for a few years. I was then an elementary principal for 3 years after that, prior to moving over to our district office where I was the director of technology and cyber education because we had our own program there in our public school. And so I spent 14 years in public schools before heading down to DC. And I've now been there for three 3 years, but I've had incredible experiences. But I tell you, you know, my view, Barbara, in the last number of years has really the scope that I can see things under, having been to some of the poorest areas in our countries, having been to some of the most urban areas and looking at the schools there as well. I've truly grown as an educator and learned just as much in the last few years that I did in my first few years as a brand new teacher as well. But thanks for having me here today. It's a little bit about me.
Wow. Well, you know, that's why I got into this also. It's because of my children. I started working in the schools and then became a teacher and then kind of worked up like you did, but not as far as you did. I work in high poverty schools here in the Bay Area. And I'm right now coaching a school in the Richmond area because I feel that it's really important to be able to connect, especially when you're not in the schools now. So I've learned so much from you. In fact, I'm on Twitter with you all the time, you know.
I see you out there all the time.
And I participated in your chat, which is EdChat. And I was wondering, how did that happen? How did you start that?
Sure. So about 5 years ago, we started EdTech Chat. It was one of I don't want to say one of the original chats, but its chats have grown exponentially in the past couple of years, as you know. You know, and EdChat was around. There was a handful of others that were around that became regular. And what I started to notice is I was doing all this guest moderating on different chats, the few ones that were out there, and we were talking about EdTech. And I remember saying to a handful of friends, it was Katrina Stevens and Susan Bearden and Sharon Plant and Alex Pachowski saying, you know, hey, you're all passionate about this tech. We got on a Google Hangout one day and we said, you know, what if we started a chat around ed tech, not the purpose being let's talk about just tools and let's just talk about devices. It was let's focus it on learning. Like, what's the learning side and then the effective use of ed tech? And so we had a Google Hangout. We didn't know who's going to show up the first night. And I'll tell you, we had probably over 100 people jump in. And to date, it's definitely one of the highest attended Twitter chats on a weekly basis. It's Monday nights from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. I have to say, because of my crazy schedule and flying, I don't get to take part as much as I would like to. Our team has expanded in the past few years. There's now about 9 or 10 of us that run it on a weekly basis. We've had guest moderators from people like Arne Duncan. It was actually his first Twitter chat that he moderated when he was the Secretary of Ed a few years ago now, to vast and just incredible educators, from superintendents to teachers to people that are doing an amazing job in schools. We avoid the sales pitch side of things. We want to talk about learning, and we want to hear from teachers and curate and collaborate throughout. So Monday nights, hope to see people there for sure.
Oh, I'm going to be there.
I know. We see you there.
It's so much fun. You know, the other thing I'm really excited about, you know, the idea of future ready. And since you started putting that out, I've been to many of your keynotes. I think you see me in the back going, yay. But when you started putting that out, there were some really exciting things that you're doing for districts. And I think I'd really like you to kind of explain a little bit what that is and where districts are involved.
Sure. So my home organization where I work in Washington, D.C. is known as the Alliance for Excellent Education. It's a bipartisan nonprofit group whose work is really focused on student achievement and students and helping kids to get to graduation. Some of our core themes are things like equity and all students, you know, all meaning all, but helping all students to have the same access and opportunity that, for instance, I had growing up in suburbia. And I recognize my privilege and I recognize where I was. And it's part of the passionate reason to help all kids have similar experiences. This is something that I had, and I recognize that. So the Alliance does a lot of work from the policy side. They do things on helping support and write pieces of things like ESSA. But again, on both sides of the aisle, both with Republicans and Democrats. One of the offshoots, under the umbrella of the Alliance for Excellent Education, has grown out as known as Future Ready Schools. And I'll be the first to say Future Ready is not just the Alliance. I fortunately get to be the face of so much of that. I feel blessed in the work that I do. I get to moderate a lot of the events, run a lot of the different events. However, it's a collaboration between over 60 organizations, from places like ISTE and COSIN to organizations like AASA for superintendents or NAESP, NASSP for principals, to teacher organizations like the AFT, the NEA, Teach for America, really supporting how do we take the work that we're all collectively doing, trying to move forward to connect and to collaborate for free for school districts. You see, Future Ready doesn't have a sales pitch. There's no product we're trying to sell. There's nothing along those lines. It is grant funded in a variety of different ways. We also have a variety of corporate sponsors that are in the space, that it's their foundations, it's their way to give back. so that we can do events and those kinds of things around the country completely free for school leaders. They don't pay for anything. They don't pay for our webinars. They don't pay for our events that we do. They just come and they network and they connect and they collaborate. It's an incredible feat, and I really encourage people to check it out. FutureReady.org. We actually launched 5 strands this year. Future Ready for the first 2 years was focused on district leadership because we really believe that we've had always pockets of great things going on in schools. Teachers will do great things, really regardless sometimes of the leadership. But to scale the work, to really blow it up in proportions of district-wide or shift districts systemically, district leadership has to be on board. And so district leadership was really our focus. We've had over 3,100 superintendents nationwide sign our Future Ready Pledge. And with that, they represent almost 20 million children in the effort that we're working with, which is truly quite a feat. I'm really proud of the incredible efforts from so many different organizations and team to make it all possible. So we have Future Ready district leaders. We have Future Ready principals, Future Ready librarians, Future Ready IT, and Future Ready instructional coaches. Each of those strands is actually overseen by 10 to 15 practitioners. People, if I'm Future Ready principals, it's 10 to 15 principals helping to run that work, guide that work. So it's not just 50,000 foot policy view here, you know, again, telling principals what to do. It's actual principals that are leading the way, that are very innovative, doing great things in schools, helping to shape the content, helping to shape the experiences for principals as they take part in our different events. Incredible feat. There is no sales pitch. It is truly just a support to move all of our schools forward with the kid at the heart and the center of the decision making.
Oh, and I know a lot of the people that are involved with you, so it's just wonderful. And definitely I tell everyone about it. I work with coaches all around the country, so I'm going to tell them about the new approach with instructional coaches now, because I think that would be good.
And just one, for instance, you know, we leverage a tool like Facebook because so many people are on something like Facebook. And so each one of those groups has its own private Future Ready, for instance, instructional coaches Facebook group. And Future Ready librarians, we launched about 6 months ago. And in that 6 months, we've had over 8,000 educators join that group. And what's really cool is you see, this is the piece about going being ongoing, where everybody has a voice. If people want to step back and just kind of lurk, they can do that too. But what'll happen is you'll see, here's the beginning of the school. You'll see something like, hey, I'm thinking about starting a makerspace this year. Who can help me and what do you think I should do? And you'll see 58 comments in a day of people saying, don't forget this, check this out. Here's a great resource. And that's the goal of networking and collaborating, not just a couple of days per year, not just a set number of hours per year, but just on an ongoing basis so we can continually be better for kids. And the other groups have launched their groups as well, and they're growing by the day, truly.
Well, we'll have to link to them because I put a blog together for this.
Sounds great.
We're going to have all the links so people can at least, you know, when they hear you talk about it, they'll know where to go if they
absolutely
listen to this. So, you know, I've read your book. I got a lot of post-it notes here. I love this book that you co-authored with Eric Scheninger. I really, really appreciate how you both got to the heart of what matters most for kids. And you started with, in the introduction, something that really, you know, touched my heart, was a sense of urgency. And you want to just kind of explain a little
Sure.
bit about that?
Yeah. So the intro of our book, and, you know, people often will ask, why did we write the book? Where did it come from? The bottom line is Eric and I both have the opportunity. We both truly feel blessed to work closely with thousands of school leaders every year. And I don't mean just speaking or a keynote. I mean in workshops and working very closely with them, where we see some of the things that they're struggling with, some of the things that are on their plate, some of the things that are really hard issues and issues that are trying to face about things like access or equity or different opportunities for kids or budget cuts. And we really wanted to put a book together to say, what are the common themes that we're seeing out there that people are struggling with, number one, but also more importantly, let me flip that and say, what are the schools and places out there that are actually doing this work, that are actually transforming? Who are they? Where are they? And what does it look like? And so throughout the book, we've got about 20 different resources and references to schools from when people hear from leading practitioners, superintendents of the year, principals of the year, to show what it looks like in their schools. And so why did we start with that sense of urgency to start that whole book? Is to really create that compelling why, to put that hook out there of what's the need to transform. You know, it was fascinating. ASCD said it was one of the highest endorsed books that they'd ever received, and we were really honored by that. when people like Sir Ken and Arnie Duncan and Dan Pink and Marzano and people like that were endorsing the book. It was quite an honor to see that. But one of the pieces of feedback we continued to get was that we set the stage with that kind of nationwide or even some places global data on this is the snapshot of what we're dealing with. Part of the reason we did that is it's so easy to become myopic and just look in our own little building or our own little school. Eric and I have learned so much in the past number of years working coast to coast with school leaders and really seeing the vast inequities that exist for places like with our females in areas such as STEM, or taking a look at opportunities for, say, our students of color that just were not prevalent in other areas of the country. And so, number one, how do we handle all of those pieces? Number two, we really wanted to create an awareness of some of those issues. And number three is our book, Throughout Learning Transformed, is very, very grounded in evidence and grounded in research. And that was really purposeful. You see, Eric and I really believe, both of us, that there's a lot of fluff out there right now in education. We hop on the latest bandwagon, we jump on the latest trend, we spend all this money, and then we look back and we're like, did it even do anything? Why did we do that? What was the evidence for it? And we've got to be better than that. Number one, we've got to be really good stewards for the money that we're spending. This is coming out of the taxpayer money, out of their wallets. We have to, as leaders, we have to spend that money well. Like, that's taxpayer money. That's our obligation to do that. But more importantly is we've got to create really robust experiences for kids. Part of that sense of urgency is helping people understand what is that world of work projected to look like, again, from my lens, for my babies when they ultimately get there. My little girl going into second grade this year is the class of 2028. My little boy will be the class of 2032, and that's just high school. And so what is the world of work going to look like in 2036 when my boy, say, walks across the graduation of college? Like, think about those pieces. That's almost 20 years from now. And when I look at that, that's the reality for my future, for my family. And so when you look at that sense of urgency, when I look at it in terms of those are my babies and that's the changing world of work, that becomes really urgent for me. And again, that's my lens, but we wanted to create that. If part of our role as educators is to prepare students for their world and their future ahead, we have to start to project, well, what is that world projected to look like? And so we use a lot of studies. I think we have over 190 different research reports and those types of things that are referenced in there to really ground it in evidence and say, if this is where that world of work is going, how do we ultimately create students and learners that are going to be successful in that world of work? Where, for instance, they're projecting almost 4 in 5 jobs that people are making under $20 an hour will eventually be automated. That came from a report to Congress last year. And well, if those predictions come true, what happens to our economy? What happens to that world of work? And where does that need to start? Where's the foundation of all of that? That's in teaching and learning in the heart in our schools, because we are today shaping those students that will be leading that future. And so it's more important than ever. That's truly why we have that sense of urgency.
Well, that's one reason why I've been doing this, even at my old age. I don't want to give up. It's about our kids. And what I love the way you and Eric laid this out, it's I can use this. I'm working with administrators also and superintendents, and I refer them to you and to Eric all the time, but I really appreciate the way that you laid everything out and the evidence and research that you put in the book, because it really helps all of us that are out there trying to transform teaching and learning. It's not an easy thing now.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Barbara, you see, when you talk about the evidence or that, and the notion of this, Sir Ken Robinson called it a blueprint. Linda Darling Haben called it a roadmap, which are both words we were very, very honored by. When you look at that, for instance, part of the way we did it purposefully is really looking, number one, what does the research say? You know, if we're going to talk about learning spaces or professional learning or redesigning the learning experience or community, what is the most compelling research that's out there say? Now, I'll tell you, there's places where the research contrasts each other, where one study will say one thing, another study will say something that contrasts it. Well, we point that out, you know, and it's okay. We didn't want to go in with some biased view of, you know, it has to be this, and we're only going to pull research that only tells this story that we want it to tell. There's times where I'm thinking in our professional learning chapter where they contrast each other, but that's important for educators to look at and kind of really ask the reason of why. And so it's not just this big research thesis or research analysis, because honestly, at the end of the day, not many people want to read just that, right? Mm-hmm. How do we take it from that to ground it in the evidence and the why, then move it to, well, what has traditional practice in that area been? Take professional learning. What has traditional practice been? You know, one size fits all, sit and get, hours-based accountability. All right, well, let's compare that to what the research actually says. And let's transform it to say then what could be, what should be, but then let's back that up with here's what districts are actually doing to make it work, and this is how it aligns to the research. And we include those as innovative practices in action. We know as IPA, not the beer, the innovative practice in action. And that way, they're hearing from people that are not just myself and Eric. They're hearing from superintendents of the year and principals of the year share their story in that area to show this is what it looks like. This is how it actually looks in the classroom. So it's not just theoretical. It's not just pie in the sky. It's not just one big research citation. It moves from the evidence to the practice. And to us, that was so important to do with every single chapter.
Well, you started with key one, which is the culture. And when I try to work, and I'm working with schools right now, and I have to tell you, I went to New Zealand. I don't know if you knew that, but it was a lot of fun just to see when you walk into school, what does it feel like? What does it sound like? And what does it look like? And what is happening in there? And when you walk in different schools, if it's still, you know, if you can change that culture, and that's why I like you start with key one, you lay that as the foundation. You wanted to say something about that?
Sure. You know, we were very purposeful with leadership and school culture setting the tone. One of the things that's interesting, Barbara, is as Eric and I have traveled the nation, we've been in some of the poorest areas. I was in a place last week in Mississippi that was still on dial-up, and they had a couple computers in the classroom on dial-up. And that's just a vastly different world. But here's the thing. We've seen some of the poorest places in the country do amazingly dynamic things. Why? Because of school leadership. We've also seen places that have it all. They're not talking about 1-to-1. They're like 2-to-1. Every kid gets an iPad and a Chromebook, you know? And they're still teaching the way they taught 20 years ago, and their kids happen to play really well. They play school really well, I should say, because they're pretty compliant kids. So when we look at that, what's the difference? The difference really comes down to leadership. I've never seen a district do amazingly transformative things without having dynamic leaders. One of the things we also point out, though, Barbara, we're not talking about leaders by title. One of the contrasts that we make when we talk about leadership, some of the best leaders that I've ever met might be a fifth-year teacher, a 10th-year teacher, that support staff member that's leading the way in certain things. It is not just what we call LBTs, leaders by title. Leaders by action is who makes the change. It's really important that those leaders by title eventually get on board, of course, but some of the best people we see are teaching in classrooms every day. And so when we talk about leadership, we're not just talking about leaders by title in that regard, but leadership and school culture absolutely lay that foundation. You could have the greatest planned whatever, some sort of initiative in a school, but in a toxic school environment, it's going to fall apart. It's not going to work. And so leadership and school culture must be foundational. And those pieces, if I could sum up in one word, I'd ground another theme throughout the book is relationships. Truly, how do we form relationships? How do we cultivate those relationships? That is the heart and soul of transformation.
You hit my heart here because this is one of the things that I've been focusing on is how do you develop those relationships. And it's not just the leader, it's also the teacher and the student. And one of the things you talk about is building student agency. And you mentioned, you know, how do you see this agency with its new, I love it, you said Netflix generation. I mean, we're all kind of going into that. Everything seems to be personalized, but what does that mean? And
sure.
I'd just like to hear your point of view on it.
You know, and I think about the lens again, and I look at my little girl who has grown up her entire life knowing digital technologies, having content on demand. She truly has no concept of what it's like to have to wait until content next week at 7 p.m. to watch her favorite TV show. She gets content on demand. You know, my 4-year-old who struggles to speak, he has severe speech issues and daddy speaks for a living, which is fascinating. Even with his struggles, he can absolutely log onto his iPad, log into Netflix, log into YouTube, get his content on demand so long that mom or dad says that it's okay. And so we've got this generation of students. Now, let me clarify, so long that they have access, because many families don't, about 5 million of our families nationwide don't have access at home. And that's a really important point there as well. Eric and I addressed that from an equity end in our book. But this Netflix generation of kids are pretty much used to content on demand. They're used to pulling out a phone. They're used to pulling out an iPad or a device at home and getting what they want, where they want. And so one of the pieces that we put, it's been a little controversial out there because I think sometimes people may interpret it poorly. But one of the pieces that we wrote in that chapter is really that if as a teacher with this Netflix generation, we still see our main role as just disseminating content if we see it as our job is to disseminate that content, we say that, well, you've been basically outsourced by YouTube and Netflix. Now, people sometimes are taking that the wrong way, and we're not saying that you should just outsource teachers with YouTube and Netflix. That is not the point. The point is, in the minds of kids, if all their teacher does is just give them content, well, they're used to getting content anytime, anywhere, any moment they want it, not during 52 minutes Monday to Friday. And so it creates this discourse. And what one of those keys is, it's an area that I consider yourself and Barbara and amazing experts on, is that notion of student agency. How can students advocate for their own learning? How can students truly take ownership of their own learning? Because, you know, it's like we talk about also in our professional learning chapter. If I could boil that chapter and boil the research on professional learning to one word, I'd probably have to put it as ownership. But that's a lot like learning in the classroom. Ultimately, how do we get kids to take ownership of their own learning? Because at the end of the day, that is not something we can mandate. We can't just stand up front and say, you must own this, and magically it all happens. That notion of agency is that inner being to say, I own this. I want to become better. I want to become that learner, because that's the type of learner our kids need to be when industries get outsourced, when industries aren't there in the years, when new industries thrive. They need the ability to adapt. That adaptability is so key. They need that ability of, okay, if I don't know how to do this, what are my tools and my resources I can use to figure it out? Just yesterday, I was eating with my little girl, and I were eating out on my screened-in porch, and she asked this question related to something, and she tried to figure it out, and she asked me, and I said, honey, you know, I don't know. And she said, why don't we Google it? And so we worked through. I said, well, honey, okay, what would be a question we could ask Google to figure out? And she perfectly puts it out there, and there's the answer. And there she is at 7 years old saying, like, well, gee, if daddy doesn't know, where else can I go? And that's the, and not to pat her on the own shoulder there, but I was so proud of that agency of, in that sense of, hey, if daddy doesn't know, where else can I figure this out? And then she can do it at seven to figure out the answers. And then I think about, I do that all the time. I don't know the answers to a lot of things. And I'm researching, I'm tapping into networks, and I'm finding that. And so how do we teach those skills to kids to become their own best advocate? So as they need to learn things moving forward, they have the understanding, the skill set to do it, but then they can continue to adapt to a world that's constantly changing.
Well, see, I see the same thing, and it's not really fair to teachers to think they have to be the expert on everything anyway. And then they're always the one held accountable for learning. We need to kind of flip that. So kids are held accountable for their own learning, and then they want to drive it. But how do you do that? And that's why I love the way that you and Eric laid it out. It really helps me a lot. I can use that.
Yeah, and we start big picture when you talk about how do we redesign the learning experience for kids? How do we get away from the teacher-centric, stand up front, deliver content for 48 of the 52 minutes, ask a handful of questions, do it for 4 or 5 days, take a quiz, because any research on that model shows it's ineffective. Every research on that model shows that the amount of content we give in that fashion isn't retained long term. So why the heck do we do it? You know, I mean, and that's a case where we've got to look at what the research says. We've got to look at what brain sciences are saying. And then if that's what we're learning in those places, that's the way we need to teach, as opposed to the way that many of us grew up. And we wonder why so many kids don't play school well, or at the end of the year, we're cramming for a final because we can't remember anything from October. Those are such clear indicators of the old method needs to transform. And that's why we led then with, once leadership and culture lay that foundation, how do we ultimately start to redesign the student learning experience? And student agency is a big part of that.
You know, I could talk to you for about a whole day. I'm just going to pull out a few more things from your book.
Sure.
Because this is like my mantra here. I'm really enjoying this so much. And I'm doing a lot on designing learning spaces, because I found that if you keep the learning space with, you even called it the cemetery effect. You know, you come into the classroom, you kind of know where you're going to sit, you're assigned seating. Well, now if you redesign these learning spaces where it's open, so you're encouraging learners to take ownership. So do you want to just kind of explain just a little bit about what I was mentioning about that?
Sure, yeah. You know, it's something that, Barbara, I was clueless on my first few years teaching. It was something I had no idea on. And one of the pieces that Eric and I start that chapter on is how design impacts learning. I had no idea as an early teacher. And part of the thing when we start talking about learning spaces is sometimes admins start seeing dollar signs of like, oh boy, this is thousands of dollars, sometimes millions of dollars in new furniture. It's not that at all. It's when we talk about learning spaces, the other thing that it's not, and I'll get to what it is, it's not about decorating and it's not about being pretty for Pinterest. There's a lot of that going on out there. You could be super pretty in terms of a class, but from a research end, be a total fail. And so I can tell you, I failed miserably when this came. I started as a brand new teacher. I created a classroom like a classroom I had learned in. That's just what I knew. I created the classroom for me and not for my kids. And so one of the compelling questions that I ask is, does the desired pedagogy you're looking for, does that match the space that you have set up? And so, for instance, if we're going to talk about all these skills that we want kids to have, problem solving, collaborating, critical thinking, you know, people are 21st century skills. I'd like to say, yeah, we're 17 years in now. Every one of these kids is born in this century, right? If those are the skills that we want, how in the world can then we turn around and say every kid sitting as an island to themselves for 52 minutes at a time is going to help get to those skills? Like they're at opposite ends. Now, some of the research shows there's a time and a place where kids should work independently, should work quietly, should reflect. And I'm a fan of that. That's fine. The problem becomes if that's all we do, then how are they problem solving, critical thinking, collaborating, connecting, and those kinds of things there as well? The space absolutely impacts that. And, you know, Eric and I dive into things like color, things like daylight, things like the setup. How do you design for things like collaboration? How do you design for things like movement? Designed truly for the brain sciences side of things on how it shows that we ultimately learn. And so there's so much to that. We were really honored. Michael Fullan gave us some incredible feedback and he called it offline. He calls it out a little bit in his quote, but the best compilation of research and resources related to learning space design that he had ever seen. And that was quite an honor to hear that from somebody that we respect so much. But it's an area that I can tell you has been a bit of a hot topic in the past couple of years, but it's not about being pretty again. It's not about decorating. It's how does design impact learning? There's a lot of design thinking with these pieces. You know, Barbara, one of the things I'm ashamed to say, but I'll just openly admit it. I try and share a lot of my failures so people can maybe relate in that regard. I never one time in my years teaching, never once did I ask kids how they would best learn in that environment. And you have to ask the question of who's the environment for anyway? Whose environment is it? You know, early on, I saw it as my environment, but man, was I misguided. It's our environment, and I would say ultimately their environment for learning. And I never once asked them how they would learn best, how we could set the classroom up differently, how we could move things around. I did it in what I thought would be best. You know, and again, the decorations, the things, we've got to be really careful. I'll just give one or two really quick examples related to the research end. Number one, what are the symbols around the classroom look like? We cite multiple studies that show, for instance, if I walk into a history room and every symbol of success is a white male, multiple studies indicate females will internalize that in a certain way. Student of color will internalize that in a different way. That's something I wasn't cognizant of my first year teaching, just wasn't on my radar. And maybe that was my white privileged self in that environment there. But when we take a look at that, that's not a financial decision. That's something we need to be really conscious of to make sure we're representing the various cultures and ethnicities in our school. It's just one quick example. One other quick example, you know, sometimes I can think back to my first or second grade classrooms when I was a principal and they were amazing teachers. They really were. They were dynamos. But I can tell you, sometimes I would walk into some of those classrooms and I'm bobbing and weaving around everything hanging from the ceiling. Every square inch of space was highlighted with something they had done that year. As a principal, I thought it was really welcoming and really warm. It showed all the work that they had done. But when you look at the research, what I didn't think about is that the research is showing that kids in that environment will be off task about 17% more and off task longer about 17% more of the time. And so what happens is I put my boy in that environment, he'd be looking all over the place. And it's kind of common sense. If there's all this stuff to look at around the classroom, I'm going to probably be looking around as opposed to in tune with my teacher. And again, that's not a financial commitment. That's being cognizant of if it's not on the classroom walls for learning, get rid of it. The things that are hanging all over the place from the ceiling as cutesy decorations and balloons and all this stuff all over the place. If it's not related to learning, it's in the way and just get rid of it. It doesn't need it. Some of that more minimalist approach can be a bit better in that environment while still having a warm, inviting feeling. It doesn't mean we don't put something like that shows our own personal interest here or there. But I got to tell you, I created that first classroom for me. I'm a big New York Giants fan, a New York Mets fan. I had lots of sports stuff all over the room. It had nothing to do with learning. It was all about me. me and not about them. And I say that humbly and with humility, because I've learned a lot since that time. Learning space design is truly about empowering learning.
Well, I'm going to have to read that again, because I'm doing a whole bunch of sessions and I've been going around and helping schools. And the one thing I noticed is that in the school I'm working at, we invited kids to come as our focus group and give us some feedback on what they would like. And that was the most empowering thing that happened.
One of the things I've recommended to school leaders along those lines too is, you know, even if you just started, because sometimes it becomes, if I'm a principal of a high school and I'm listening to this, it can become overwhelming, because you can be talking 150 different spaces in your building. Start with one area. If I'm a classroom teacher, start with one area of the classroom. And it could be as simple as pulling a group of kids and saying, hey, what could we do differently in this space? What would you guys want? And I never did that. And I'm kicking myself years later, be like, how did I not ever think to do that? You know, and I think maybe because it was focused on me and not on them. But if I'm a principal and I pull three or four kids or whatever, kids that might be interested, and say, hey, is there a place in our building that causes anxiety? Is there a place in our building that you avoid because it's just kind of dull and what if we could pull $200 to do something really cool with this space? What would you guys do? And just leave it to them and let them be empowered to do it. When they would start to own that space, that also gets to agency. When you look at some of the other learning space design, when kids have, from a research end, when kids feel like they have some ownership in that space, they'll do better academically. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer, but the research actually backs that up. And so when they feel like they own some of this space, as opposed to being a visitor in your space as the teacher, that's a very different notion there. The achievement will soar, and there's no surprises there. It really shouldn't be. And it's an area that I've grown personally tremendously a lot in the past 5 to 6 years.
Well, it's interesting because in working with some teachers, they're still resistant, some of them, to do that. But it's starting to happen. And if we give more and more examples and you kind of just sharing some of our own failures and vulnerabilities that we did, and just say that, you know, we're learning also, and asking the kids, I think it really made a difference.
And Barbara, the last thing I'll share there, two of the things that we share in the book, one comes from a librarian in Parkland School District in Pennsylvania that I wanted to give a shout out to. Her name is Sam Edwards. And what she did is she started as the librarian to take note in some of these spaces, and she reached out to the community. And she started to say, hey, moms and dads, are you tired of? And she started to create these maker spaces. Are you tired on stepping on Legos? Do you have any extra of these? And she got flooded with donations of parents that were like, get this out of my house. I don't need it anymore. It led to a $50,000 PBS related, I guess PBS highlighted them. It led to a $50,000 grant to do what she had done in the other elementary schools, because she took the time to think differently, because she took the time to reach out to her community. She had a dad who was a carpenter come in, and he was like, on a Saturday, I'll come build things for you. I'd love to help my child's school. And so it led to this grant. It led to other experiences for kids. And there was a teacher thinking differently about spaces, wanting to design a bit of a makerspace, reaching out to resources in the community that cared. And look what happened from it. The story we tell is from Elizabeth Ford at the end of that chapter, an amazing school district in Pennsylvania, where they're prioritizing learning spaces. And they're transforming places like their libraries, transforming different other environments to ultimately transform learning for kids. And so it is absolutely happening nationwide. My plea is always just please focus on the design for learning, not on being pretty or not on decorating. They are two totally different things. And it's important we keep focused on learning, not on being pretty.
Well, I'm going to have to end our podcast, but I like I said, I could go forever with you. This is just exactly what I'm doing. And I love your book. I love your talks. I hope everyone takes some time when you go to a conference. Make sure you see Tom, because you are doing what we need to do, and you and Eric. And thank you so much. Is there anything you want to just add before I close? Or
sure, thanks, Barbara. And I would say, you know, just for any school leaders listening, ASCD also has a free study guide online for the book for anybody that's interested. Something that Eric and I wrote free for school leaders that can be downloaded online there. But ultimately, at the end of the day, Barbara, all of our work is about loving and caring about kids. It is about relationships, and it is about doing whatever we can to help our kids be successful. Without those pieces, nothing else really matters. at the end of the day. And we want to make sure that we are doing whatever we can for kids to feel cared for, kids to feel safe where they are. For the challenge for any teachers that start the school year in the next number of weeks, what are you going to do day one and day two where kids are running back to you, dying to get back to school? Let's turn kids on to learning. You have the power to do that, and you have the power to truly empower the future generations of our country. So with that, Barbara, thanks so much for having me on today.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Tom.
Absolutely. Thank you, Barbara.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining Rethinking Learning podcast today with Tom Murray. And we will be sharing more about Tom and Learning Transformed on the blog. Thank you so much, Tom. Thank you for listening to the Rethinking Learning podcast and my conversation with Tom Murray. So make sure you visit barbarabray.net to learn more about Tom and read the blog that has all the information that we talked about, including Future Ready and his book, Learning Transformed. So please subscribe so you can join the conversations.